I want to welcome onto Radio Gorgeous Anna Metsola, author of The Unseeing and just out now, The Storykeeper. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
For our listeners, could you introduce them, in your words, to the story of The Storykeeper?
So The Storykeeper follows the story of Audrey, who is a young woman who lives in London and has to leave London for reasons you will find out later in the book, in order to become the assistant to a folklorist on the Isle of Skye. And she's tasked with collecting folklore and fairy tales from the local crofting communities, but she finds them hostile. And gradually she comes to realise the reason for that hostility and to uncover some of the secrets that are going on the island.
And there are many levels of secrets, because she was born on Skye and her mother visited there, and she visited there with her mother. And we find out certain things about her history.
Mm-hmm.
And also, on the front of the book, it says, first they took the land, then they took the stories, then they took the girls.
Yes, and so the reference to the land is about the Highland clearances. So this book is taking place in 1857, which is after the bulk of the Highland clearances, when people were taken from the land. People, the local crofting community, the poor people, were removed from their land and forced into other more crowded crofting communities or put on boats to Canada, America, Australia. So this is a time of real trauma. And not only is the land taken, but then the culture and the stories are taken from the people, because they're told they can't speak Gaelic, they can't have the fireside gatherings that had previously been such an important part of their culture. So it's a time where everything is being taken from these people, and then girls start to go missing. So that's what that's about.
And the clearances, I mean, they were brutal. And it's, to me, sort of that weird moment, because as you say, Audrey Hart is from London, and there's another store aspect to the story that comes in, which is sort of the beginnings of what we see in the legal system, present day legal system. Mm-hmm. So sort of a modernization is happening there, and yet this is the end of the feudal system. I mean, this is the laird owned the land.
Yes.
And the people.
Yes, effectively. And that was the problem, that these people didn't legally own the land. They had no right to it, and therefore they were turfed off it when they realised that it was more lucrative to let the land for sheep farming and deer farms. But of course, to these people, this was their home. This was the only home they'd ever known. And in the book, Audrey walks to some of the what are effectively ghost villages, where the Borereg and Siwishnish, where all that remains is kind of the burnt stones of the houses, where people have been removed from their houses and their homes have been burnt to prevent them from returning. So, yeah, it was a very interesting time to set a novel, and part of the reason that I set it then. But also partly because that was the time in which people were starting to really collect folklore. That was the era in which people realised that these stories were vanishing, and therefore it was important to write them down. And that is, of course, the reason that Miss Buchanan, the folklorist and the storykeeper, gives for writing these stories down, although we discover later that that's not her only reason.
Yes. Yeah. And tell me about some of these folk tales, because some of them are woven through the story. They're exploited within the story and distorted.
So many of the stories that occur within The Storykeeper are real stories that come either from the Isle of Skye or from other Scottish islands. And then also interwoven through the story, as you said, is a sort of fairy tale, folk tale, which you don't find out until the end who's writing it. But that it comes partly from the real folklore and partly from my twisted mind. But yeah, it was very interesting reading the actual Celtic folklore, because so much of it is so dark. I mean, really weird stuff happens. In fact, I started reading some of it to my children and realised that it was just too traumatic for them, because, I mean, there's things about people having their fingers removed and then using them as a ladder in order to climb a tree. You know, really peculiar things, which obviously was a gift to me as a writer.
And what drew you to this time and this place and this particular bent on the story?
Well, it all started with I knew I wanted to create my own dark fairy tale, and I knew I wanted to be historical, so I did a lot of reading around, and I came across the case of the West Ham vanishings, which were where several girls went missing from the East End of London, and one of them was said to have briefly reappeared before her final disappearance. Eliza Carter was her name, and she said that she'd been taken by the fairies. I thought that was very peculiar. So I started looking into that, and in fact, there's only one reference to the fairies. Other people say that she was afraid of a man, that she was afraid of something else. So I decided that rather than using the real West Ham vanishings case, I would use that as sort of the jumping off point for my own story, and I wouldn't have it in London. I would have it somewhere where fairy tales and folklore were far more real and believed in the mid-19th century. So that meant probably either Ireland or Scotland or the Scottish Islands. And then when I went to Skye, I saw what a sort of strange and beautiful place it was, and it has its own folklore, and I therefore thought this was a good setting.
And in fact, on Skye, the fairy pools are one of the largest attractions.
They are. They don't feature in the novel, unfortunately, but the fairy pools are beautiful. Have you been?
Yes.
They're absolutely stunning. So yes, do go, although it is, I mean, Skye, over the past few years, has become inundated with tourists. So obviously I thought I'd help them by writing a novel on which really bad stuff happens.
Make it dark and gothic, and more will come.
Or maybe not, yes.
Yeah, somewhat like Graham McRae Burnett did for Applecross.
Yes, absolutely. Love that book. Yes. It's wonderful, his Bloody Project. Such a good book, yeah.
And also, again, dealing with the clearances and the power structures or lack of power structures.
Absolutely, yes.
Was a big echo for me in your book. But going back to the unseeing and continuing on with the storykeeper, there is a real preoccupation with the powerlessness and the position of women.
Yes, there is. And that comes, so in my day job, I'm also a criminal justice solicitor, and I often deal with women's justice issues. And I am particularly interested in justice, injustice, the role of women. And the 19th century obviously is very interesting because women had relatively little power. They had no ownership of their own possessions when they became married. They effectively became a possession. And I was interested in what would happen to a woman who decided she didn't want to be married, who wanted more from life, who wanted some kind of career for herself, which is what happens to Audrey. She's an intelligent, educated woman. She wants something more than marriage, and she therefore becomes seen as odd and peculiar. And she can't tell her father that she intends to become a folklorist assistant. She just has to leave and let him deal with the repercussions.
Yes, and she's sort of a different... There's sort of every social strata of women who are sort of dealing with that. There's Miss Buchanan, who is also unmarried and is allowed to indulge being a folklorist in a way that Audrey is not. Being middle class, she either has to earn, you know, or be married. Mm-hmm. So she's in a different thing. And then there's Myrie, I think. I forget how this...
Yeah, or Mayrie, yeah.
Mayrie, the Scottish pronounce it, excuse me. But she is a girl alone.
Yes.
And obviously has to work and be taken in. But they all have to... There's something that they are required to compromise of themselves.
Yes, you are absolutely right. Yeah, so Miss Buchanan, who's the lady folklorist, she is, as you say, allowed in a way to become a folklorist because she's a rich, eccentric woman, and she's allowed sort of to have her, and that's part of the reason she does it, because she wants to have her own autonomy, she wants to have some kind of life for herself, but she... also comes up against her brother, Lord Buchanan, who disagrees with the whole thing and thinks it's nonsense. And then, of course, as you say, Mary, who's the servant girl who's taken in when she's very young because she's been orphaned, she also has a great love for the stories and effectively becomes Audrey's assistant. But this is all authorised by another woman, by Lady Buchanan. So, yes, and, you know, by the end of the novel, they've formed their own sort of structure, their own power structure. But, yes, you're right that they're all women who are very much compromised by their time.
Mm. What's also interesting is that how, and I think, again, we see this in modern times, how native language is used as a barrier, as a badge of honor, as, you know, I see what's happened to the Welsh language, which is fantastic, but it is also a political tool.
Yeah.
And the disallowing of people to speak Gaelic, and then also barring, you know, when the Crofters want to sort of exclude Audrey, then everything's in Gaelic.
Yes, yeah, that's right. So this is a time where children in schools were being told not to speak Gaelic, they were being told to speak English, they were given Bibles in English, and of course it was their language. And that's, yes, you're right, I use that in the story Keeper, so that their language does become something that is very much part of their community, but which they can also use to shut others out. So Audrey can speak some Gaelic, but she can't speak it in the same way that they can. So it's used as another way of getting rid of her, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And of stealing people's stories, if you steal their language.
Yes, absolutely. You steal their language, you steal their stories. Yeah. It's difficult for them to stick together and
be bonded
and rise up against what's happening to them. Yeah.
Yeah. And the power structures of the men in the story also remain, as, you know, in the church, the laird, you know, he has the money, he makes the decisions. The church has an authority which is at the time all male. And, you know, Father Patriarch has the power, you know, over Audrey as well.
Yeah.
So these were all timely structures that have changed to some degree.
They have changed to some degree, as you mentioned, there's another part of the story which, you know, is about abuse. I think we can say that. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting looking at what would have happened in the 19th century as opposed to now. And I, in fact, spoke to this fascinating professor who dealt specifically with sexual abuse in the 19th century, and looking at what would have happened to men who abused. And the reality is nothing. If it was an upper class man, certainly if it was a man of the church, these men would never even have been prosecuted. So that was interesting, because obviously I wanted the men who had carried out bad acts to be punished, but I also wanted to be true to the time, which meant that I had to find some other remedy for them. But yes, certainly they would have met, some of the lower class men may have got to the courts, but no upper class man ever would have been even charged.
Yeah.
It might have been dealt with privately by the families, but if it was a lower class girl and an upper class man, forget about it.
Yeah.
Really quite extraordinary.
Yes, and therefore why it's much more believable at the time to think it was fairies rather than...
Yes, absolutely.
A man.
And easier to think it was fairies, yeah.
It was safer to think it was fairies.
It was safer to think there was something supernatural going on, yeah.
Exactly. And talk to me a little bit more about the elements of the legal elements, because as you say, you are a criminal justice solicitor. Tell me about some of those elements that creep in and the historical aspect of that, both in The Unseeing and...
Yeah, so The Unseeing was... My first novel was based, albeit loosely, on the real case of a woman who was convicted of a murder in 1837 in London. So that was obviously more tied in closely with the British justice system. And The Storykeeper also deals with the British justice system, but to a somewhat lesser degree. And yeah, it was fascinating reading about the contrast between the system then and the system now. And in fact, there are many similarities. So trials would have been much shorter. But that, you know, some of the problems that Sarah Gale faced in The Unseeing are still problems that women in the justice system face now, the sort of prejudices that they come up against. And what was really interesting is that I actually went to HMP Thameside a few weeks ago to talk about The Unseeing, and it's a male prison, but they had all read the book, which was amazing, and lots of them related it to their own experiences within the justice system, their own experiences of having witness evidence used against them when the witnesses were obviously unreliable, their own experience of justice being blind. So that was a really interesting experience, learning that, you know, what they took from that that is still going on now.
And does that sort of help inform your day job in a strange way?
Not really. I mean, it makes me think about it, I suppose, in a slightly different way, but it doesn't directly inform it. And I try, you know, obviously it's important for me to keep the two strands of my life separate.
As much as that is possible.
Yeah.
How and why did you decide to start writing?
It was actually when I was on maternity leave with my first child. This is terrible to say, but I was bored. I mean, children are lovely, but when they're very young, there's, you know, you're going to little play groups and doing music time or whatever, and the brain does start to stagnate somewhat, so I decided
I was gonna say it is quite a repetitive
it's very repetitive, especially when they're very little. And I've long loved books and I studied English, but somehow it had never really occurred to me that I might myself be a writer. But I started doing a creative writing course in Peckham with a wonderful woman who runs a course called Literary Kitchen. And I did a beginner's course with her, and because my son slept a lot, my daughter doesn't, but my son used to sleep for 2, sometimes 3 hours in the afternoon. So what I would do was, rather than clean up the house or whatever it was I should have been doing, I sat in a cafe with him and I wrote. So I wrote a short story based on this crime that I read about, this woman who was convicted of this murder, and I wrote many other short stories. And then I later came back to the first one, because that was what really drew my attention, and it became my first novel.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Can we have some idea of what you might be working on now?
Yes, sure. I mean, it is early days with my third novel, and I've just found out I need to entirely rewrite it because I've got the wrong narrator, which makes my heart sink, but it's always the way. My third one is, if it comes to the light of day, is about an automaton maker in 18th century Paris. So it's set in 1750, which is the time of the vanishing children of Paris, which is when children start vanishing from the streets for reasons that people don't initially understand. So it's missing people again, but it's also automata and weird stuff happening in Paris. So yeah, I'm having good fun with that one at the moment, doing lots of research. And
well, I hope it involves going to Paris.
Oh, absolutely. So do I. Now, I found out they have an automata museum in Paris, so essential research trip coming
up,
I think. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, fantastic. Absolutely can't wait to hope that one gets the light of day.
So
hope
do
gets
I.
The go ahead.
Thank you.
Get the right narrator and it goes ahead. Yeah. And thank you so much for coming on to
Oh, no, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed speaking to you. Thank you.